Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Let me just pause for a minute while this loads. There we go. Okay, in the next 20 minutes, I'm going to pretty much do what it says on the tin. In other words, tell you what it says on the slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about Scotland. I'm going to talk about the UK's National Health Service, in particular the Scottish version of it. I'll explore the concept of mutuality and what that might mean in the Scottish Health Service. And then finally, I'll talk about a project that I'm involved in, which is evaluating whether direct elections to Scottish health boards may actually help or hinder this concept of mutuality, which has become so important in terms of our conception of the Scottish National Health Service. Now, in terms of interest, we have no personal interest, but I think in the spirit of completeness, let me just state that the funding for the evaluation of the direct elections was won by competitive tender by myself and my colleagues, who I will introduce in a minute, from the Scottish Government. However, crucially, our findings, including that which I will present to you today, are entirely independent of government influence. So, having convinced you we're not a bunch of crooks, let me just introduce them. Starting from the right, Ellen Stewart, beside her Ian Wilson. The stuffy British academic in the tie is me. The very cool, laid-back looking academic on the left is Scott Greer from the University of Michigan. That's the team that is involved. In order for this to make sense, I need to tell you a little bit about Scotland. The sovereign state is actually the United Kingdom. It's a democratic monarchy. It's a member of the United Nations and of UN organisations such as the World Health Organization. But the UK actually consists of four separate parts: England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And until 1707, Scotland actually was an independent country in its own right. And I haven't got time today to tell you the hilarious story of how it lost its independence, but it really is worth looking up. I mean, it's full of skullduggery and political intrigue and just ocean-going incompetence, unbelievable ocean-going incompetence. It basically fell apart when it decided, like all European powers, it needed an empire. Rather than choose to go and do it somewhere nice, like New England, it went to a malaria-infested isthmus in Panama, and half of the settlers died of malaria within the first year. The whole thing became a disaster. The nation became nearly bankrupt, and as a last resort, they merged with England. However, in the 300 years that followed, they did, rather cleverly, manage to maintain their own legal system, which is actually based on French law. Their educational system, which again is much more like the French baccalaureate than it is the English A-level system. And they maintained many national institutions, crucially, including those involved in medicine. So they have their own royal colleges of physicians and of surgeons, and a very strong university tradition. For the geographically challenged, here is the United Kingdom. It's colour-coded, the blue is Scotland, England below, Wales to the west, and Northern Ireland. Southern Ireland, or ERA, the Irish Republic, is an entirely separate nation and is a sovereign state, a member of the European Union and of the United Nations. In terms of population, 62 million in the UK, 52 million of them in England, 5 million in Scotland, 3 in Wales, 2 in Northern Ireland, rounded figures. What's quite important to realise, I don't think we have a pointer, so let me come round very quickly and shout so you can still hear me. Okay, for Scotland, the capital here is Edinburgh, the biggest city here is Glasgow. Most of the people live here. St Andrews is just there. Dundee, Aberdeen, Inverness, the rest of this stuff is absolutely beautiful, but is mostly forestry, sheep, lakes, deer. It's not populated, is my point. The population is not evenly spread, and that becomes relevant as we move through this. So Scotland loses its parliament, 300 years almost pass, but there is a continuing campaign to do something about this. The process was known as devolution. And eventually, the politicians agreed that Scotland could have a referendum. And they voted to restore their own parliament, which should have tax-varying powers. And that first met in 1999. So we're 12 years in. Now, the way this works is that unless something is specifically reserved to London, to the United Kingdom, everything else is fair game for the Scottish Parliament. So defence and foreign policy are held in London, but everything else, crucially, including health, is devolved to Scotland. This is the Scottish Parliament. Don't adjust your eyes. It's not your eyes. The slide is slightly out of focus. I show it for a purpose. If any of you have ever seen the debates from Westminster in London, you will see that there are two sides facing each other in opposition. The history buffs amongst you will know that the two sides are deliberately two sword lengths apart, so that in the old days they couldn't actually whack each other. But the Scottish Parliament was designed in a different way. It's this kind of horseshoe thing, and the idea was to make it less adversarial, actually to try and get people to discuss, compromise and agree. And many of their parliamentary procedures are similarly designed. The very way in which people are elected to the Parliament is also consistent with a more consensual approach to politics. So they have a partially proportionate system. So 73 members are elected on a first-past-the-post system, but then there are so-called top-up members, 56 of them, which are added in to bring the representation in Parliament more in line with the overall popular vote. Now, this was designed in part to try and ensure that nobody would ever have an overall majority, and that in the majority of parliaments, there would in effect have to be a coalition. So much for Scotland and its democratic processes. I need, now I need to tell you a little bit about the National Health Service. So a brief history. Founded at the end of the war, 1948. Not free, as many people would term it, but certainly free at the point of usage. It's not free because it's funded from central taxation that everybody pays. It provides comprehensive care. Everybody, as a right, is covered by it. The quality in general is satisfactory, and the wait times, which were at one point a problem, are now greatly reduced. Devolution, just over 10 years ago, brought about a number of different trajectories for health in the four United Kingdom countries. England has moved progressively towards the introduction of private provision and competition. The next move that they are in the process of making is to hand over the commissioning of secondary and tertiary services to consortia of family doctors. What they are pursuing in England is really based on the concept of a mixed but managed market. Now, in the face of that, Scotland has not only chosen not to follow them, but has gone at some pace in the opposite direction. So Scotland has done away with any remains of a purchaser-provider split. And the 14 geographically defined health boards are simply given a lump sum of money based on the size of their population, weighted for age, weighted for deprivation, and are told to get on with it and provide a comprehensive healthcare service. They can, if they like, use private providers. Very, very few of them choose to do so. They largely provide the service themselves. Now, why should that difference have arisen between two neighbouring countries who had such similar history? Well, partly it is that there was already more private practice in England, particularly in the affluent southeast of England. Some have argued, including my colleague Scott Greer, that in Scotland, health professionals, who in general in our country favour a centrally provided, a state-provided NHS, are more powerful. Scotland's geography, which I caricatured for you, actually makes meaningful competition very difficult in all but the two largest cities. There is a different political landscape in Scotland. The opposition always seems to be coming from the left. The Conservatives in Scotland are very weak. The Nationalist Party is left of centre, Labour is left of centre, and even the Liberal Democrats are to the left in Scotland of Liberal Democrats who are elected in England. But I also want to explore with you the concept of mutuality. Now, what on earth does mutuality mean? Well, it is rather ill-defined. But it incorporates concepts of solidarity, of equity, of collective ownership, and of personal responsibility. You could summarise it in relation to the National Health Service by saying it's our National Health Service. And that would be something that people in Scotland would feel and would say. Moreover, mutuality is very, very deeply embedded in the Scottish national psyche. Our national poet, an 18th century gentleman called Robert Burns, who many of you may know of, used to use phrases like, a man's a man for all that. In other words, everybody is equal in the light of the law. It is the idea that the Duke and the dustman are equal in standing. More recently, popular Scottish folk bands like the Corries penned words for songs like Scotland Will Flourish, which again talks about this concept of collectivism, of solidarity, and of mutuality. Crucially, the concept of mutuality was picked up on and championed by Derek Feely, even before he became the head of Scotland's NHS. Now, it's always a bit risky, frankly, to decide that based on a poem or a song that maybe there is something culturally significant and different about any nation. And that was never more true than with Robert Burns, because Robert Burns is not only beloved by the Scots, but actually the Soviet Union were kind of keen on him as well. And in case you think it's all just us left-wingers who like him, this is from Central Park in New York. This statue is from Central Park in New York. So there clearly were at least some Americans who also were taken with the poetry of Robert Burns. And as many of you will probably know, there are about half a dozen of your founding fathers, of the people who actually signed at the time the Declaration of Independence, who were either frankly Scottish or at least had Scottish roots. So I suspect that Robert Burns has had an influence rather beyond our Scottish borders. The question, however, remains why the head of the Scottish NHS should be so keen on this concept of mutuality. Well, it's partly because the NHS in the UK is heavily unionised. Unionised is not a four-letter word. The unions, actually, in Scotland have been very responsible, have been responsible activists, and are very involved in what we term partnership working within our health boards, such that they have a seat on the management board of each one of the 14 health boards. Mutuality reinforces this tradition. It is also perhaps a way of encouraging people to take responsibility for their own health. If you believe the health service is our health service, you perhaps have a moral responsibility to do something about your own health. Finally, one could argue that it is a way to help manage expectations. So what about direct elections? Well, For a number of years, when Mrs. Thatcher was in power in England and there were no Conservative MPs in Scotland, Scotland was run by people who felt like they were an outside force. During that period, many people were appointed to run health boards simply because of who they knew. So you would find the wife or husband of a constituency Conservative chairman suddenly cropping up as the chair of a health board. This led to a lot of unrest, and it led from all of the opposition parties to an escalating bidding war of promises as to how they would put this right. The ultimate promise came from the Nationalist Party, who said, "We will directly elect people to these boards." However, when they eventually came to power, they only had a minority government. They couldn't push it through, and they decided that they would pilot it in two of the 14 boards first. We have been retained to evaluate this. We're looking at the electoral process, we're looking at the candidates, how much this all costs, and whether indeed it does any of the things they hoped it would do. Increasing representativeness, improving the functions, improving the accountability of boards. But how does all of this gel with mutuality? Is it going to help or hinder? One of the worries is that people may arrive on boards with very parochial interests. They may have been elected because they want to save their local hospital. Or perhaps they've been elected by a particular interest group. Perhaps they're only interested in the elderly or in kids. They may just use the health board elections as a way to launch a bigger political career. Or perhaps they're only interested in their small local town and can't see the bigger picture. On the other hand, maybe it really will get people to focus and value the NHS. Maybe participation is the way to get people to take issues of healthcare seriously. Perhaps there will be a more open and informed debate because we have directly elected members. So, one of the things we've been doing is some election research. We've been observing the process, we've been surveying voters, interviewing voters and candidates, and taking focus groups, particularly with 16 and 17-year-olds who for the first time were allowed to vote. Let me share, just in the last few minutes, some results that have emerged thus far. There were plenty of candidates, 60 and Fife and 70 in Dumfries and Galloway, but here's the thing. Male, well-educated, over 60. They're frankly not that different from the people who ended up on health boards anyway. I don't think there is any evidence as yet that we are increasing the representativeness of health boards by going down this process. Second thing is look at the overall turnout. 22% turnout of the electorate in one place, under 14% in the other. Now, perhaps in common with the United States, local elections are not particularly good in terms of getting people to turn out. But this is a particularly poor turnout. Disappointingly, amongst 16 and 17-year-olds who are allowed to vote for the first time, it is even lower, 13% and 7% respectively. What's more, if you look at the age of those who are turning out to vote, it is predominantly older people who are turning out to vote. They are atypical of the electorate as a whole. So the story so far. It is at least possible to hold direct elections to health boards. The turnout, however, is low, particularly amongst the young. The candidates really are not terribly different from those who might have ended up on boards anyway. They tend to be older, well-educated, middle-class professionals. Males are still in the preponderance. I could also have added on this slide that those who vote are also older. And so it remains to be seen what effect these elections will have on the concept of mutuality within the Scottish NHS. If you're interested in following the story as it develops, please drop me an email. That is my email at the University of St Andrews, and I'll be happy to try and keep you informed. The one thing that I can just add in the 30 seconds or so I have left is that since making up some of the earlier slides around this story, there has been a general election in Scotland, and the Nationalists have won not just a majority but an overall majority, which was almost inconceivable when they designed the electoral system. It gives them an absolutely delicious challenge around this situation, because the fact that they were in minority meant that they could pilot it and not bring it in. The fact that they now have a majority actually makes it rather more difficult for them to stall and not bring it in. And what many people have argued is that the call for increased representativeness and accountability on Scotland's health boards is largely a policy of opposition rather than a policy of government. Thank you for your attention.